delights in the sway of the wicked one, refusing the rule of the risen sun. Fools in high places, ruling over you, holding the aces as they lie to you. You gotta dig for the truth until you find it.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to TMR's very first film review podcast, for which we are welcoming none other than Frank Johnson and Mark Campbell, two of the high-ranking members of the Fireside Nephilim Boys, who we have a fun chat with each New Year's Eve. Now, a little over a year ago, Mark, Frank and I hit upon the idea, a good idea I think, at the time, of doing the occasional film review as a roundtable discussion on TMR, and we thought it was such a good idea that we waited over a year to start doing it. Now, the simple fact was that busyness, one way or another, has basically put the idea on hold until now, until today, when we're going to start this off with a film that I think we said we would start with, the conspiracy-themed classic made-for-TV movie from 1970 starring Glenn Ford called The Brotherhood of the Bell, that no doubt many of you will know, and equally doubtless many of you will not know, but more of that in just a moment. Gentlemen, good to speak with you again. Welcome to this round table.
Thank you for having me, Julian. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me also. I always like being with you.
It's great to speak to both of you, and thanks very much for agreeing to do it, and especially after this huge gap. Anyway, so let's get on with this. So The Brotherhood of the Bell, I believe it was my suggestion, because I just basically love this movie. I thought it'd be a good one to start the series, however long that series turns out to be, whether it's 1, 12, 120 or whatever, because it deals with themes, sort of conspiracy themes in media, propaganda, social engineering, mind games, hidden elite power, those sorts of things. Themes that, you know, we've explored in one way or another over the years here at TMR. So I thought it would be a great one to start with. But also because I first saw this film when I was about 10 years old, and it intrigued me. It was on one afternoon, and there I was alone in the room, and I thought, oh, what's this all about? And, you know, I thought to myself, is this a window onto something real? Or is this just a story? And something always made me feel that it was more than just a good story. And no doubt that was sort of instrumental in pricking up my antenna for matters conspiratorial ever since. Not that I'm overly given to that kind of thing, but I think I'm open to the possibility of such matters. And I think this probably did have some kind of influence. Anyway, Mark and Frank, let me ask you first of all, I suggested this film. Had either of you seen this film before?
No, I'd never heard of it. Never heard of it, and luckily it's on YouTube, so you suggested it and I watched it. Excellent. But I had no knowledge of it.
Frank, had you come across it before?
No, actually, when you suggested it, I'd never heard of this movie, and I actually thought it was related to a book I had read maybe 5-10 years ago called SS Brotherhood of the Bell, like a Nazi conspiracy thing, where the book is kind of all over the place, but it's basically about, like, the Nazis had this secret thing they call the Bell or Die Glocke. And it's said to be either like a time machine or a UFO or an energy source. They're really all over with what it is. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm going to see a movie about this Nazi time machine or something. And that's going to be the awesomest movie. And then I started watching it and I'm like, oh, that's not what this is about, but it's still pretty cool. Okay.
Oh, dear. So I'm sorry. You were slightly disappointed there. Well, fancy thinking that's what I would suggest, Frank.
I went in with like expectations of Nazi conspiracies and walked into some other different kind of conspiracy. So an easy transition, at least.
You thought it'd be like Boys from Brazil or something.
I honestly thought it was going to be something like that. Yeah.
Oh, well, hopefully we will still enjoy talking about this, even though it's perhaps not quite so sensational as that. Although, actually, you've whet my appetite for that one. okay, so let's just give a brief overview of this, and then we'll have a more detailed conversation about it. So, okay, so as I said before, this is a made-for-TV movie. Actually, I think it's good enough to have been a Hollywood blockbuster in its own right. From 1970, starring Glenn Ford, Rosemary Forsyth, Dean Jagger, and Morris Evans, amongst others, of course, and directed by Paul Wendkos, who apparently was nominated in the following year for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in TV, produced by David Karp, whose book it's based on, and who also wrote the screenplay. Great music by the one and only Jerry Goldsmith, mm-hmm. who did, you know, things like Planet of the Apes, Patton, The Boys from Brazil, as you've already mentioned, and Alien. Great scores from
first Star Trek film, didn't he?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think he did Star Trek. Yeah. Yeah, he did Star Trek.
Yeah, he seemed to have that great ability to capture the mysteriousness mm-hmm. by using sort of dissonant and rather avant-garde sounds. That's always appealed to me, and to see that actually happen and be effective in movies is great. And he does that, of course, in this film as well, which will no doubt come up for conversation in a few minutes. Anyway, the detail then here, the sort of synopsis, it tells the story of an economics professor, or lecturer, as we say over here in the UK, Dr. Andrew Patterson, played by Glenn Ford, who got involved when he was an undergraduate at university with a mysterious secret society at college called Beta Epsilon Lambda, mm-hmm. which of course spells out B-E-L, Bell, hence the Brotherhood of the Bell, which kind of turned out well for him for most of the time in his career, benefited from his being a member in all kinds of ways, even beyond his knowledge, until 22 years later, which is where the film actually starts. He has to go back. He gets invited back to the fraternity's HQ at his old college where he was a student to initiate a new member into the society and to receive an assignment that he's got to carry out. And this is assignment he must carry out of loyalty to the secret group. And it turns out to be really obnoxious. He has to try to persuade an academic colleague of his to turn down an important job offer, a deanship at a university, simply because the fraternity has in mind that somebody else should have that position. So he's got to try and persuade this person to turn it down, this choice job offer. And if that colleague refuses, then Dr. Patterson is provided with a dossier of information, basically to blackmail this colleague into submission. So reluctantly, he carries out the assignment. The colleague freaks out and unfortunately commits suicide. And then the film goes on with the situation where Patterson is in deep remorse about this, and he decides to break the story to the world about the assignment, about the wickedness of this assignment and the devious society that he belongs to. But of course, the influence of this secret society is bigger than he realizes, and every technique is thrown against him to undermine his credibility. He loses his job and his wife and his standing in society. He's called a nutcase. He goes to the media to blow the whistle. It ends up working against him. And it all looks like it's going to be totally black. Although there is a chink of light right at the end, because his boss ends up believing his story and hits on the idea of persuading other members of the society to come forward and break the story. And it's left open there as to whether that's effective or not. So it's one of those films where you have to kind of make up your mind for yourself where you think it's going to go. Loads of perceptive ideas in this story. As I say, great music, well directed, well acted, and themes that connect, I think, with many people's experience, you know, finding themselves at odds with mainstream explanations and the discomfort of that and the pressure you feel when you want to share things with other people that go against sort of mainstream explanation. So I do think it's a great film. So we're going to talk about it in some detail. So before we get going with that, any thoughts, chaps, on, you know, the synopsis I've just presented here and perhaps some of the themes that this film presents?
I had one thought that's been burning in my mind while you were talking about this, and I'm thinking, why did it take him like 20 something years to figure out they were sinister? I mean, did they just like do nothing else like this in his whole time he was a member, or did he just kind of brush it off and be like, oh, it's not a big deal? And I know they don't get into this, but it's kind of a question that popped up. It's like, so he just kind of either turned a blind eye all this time, or did nothing untoward ever came up until just now, you know? Do you know, did they address any of that, or?
Well, you know, I think it's a good question, because I reckon that what happened was that he knew he was going to at some point receive his due bill, which is this assignment that he would have to do. Mm-hmm. Right at the beginning, it was mentioned. And I remember, you know, this new initiate is there in the early scenes of the film, and you can see the kind of discomfort on his brow, you know, as he's got to take the oath and he's just been told there's going to be this assignment, this due bill he's got to pay at some point during his time. But he goes ahead and he says the oath and all that. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that for Dr. Patterson, the paying of that due bill has not happened for those 22 years. Mm. And so he, as far as he's concerned, he's just lived his life, his academic life, and he's benefited. He doesn't realize the extent to which, when it comes out in the film, that all his success really is due to this, the influence of this society. And he doesn't really realize this. He's kind of forgotten that. And 22 years later, he's invited back. He doesn't know he's even going to get the assignment until after this new initiation is over. And then it hits him. So I reckon he was sort of in denial, but perhaps sort of put it to the back of his mind that kind of thing. And of course, it wasn't necessarily going to be an evil assignment. I think at some point he's told in the film, you know, it'll be an assignment. It could be onerous. It could be light. It's just, you know, the cookie crumbles kind of thing.
Maybe he's thinking, oh, maybe in 20 years I'll have to hire my, I don't know, sponsor's son at my college or something, you know, thinking, oh, then that's paid up, you know.
Yeah, it could have been that, couldn't it?
I just wasn't sure. Like, it, I mean, I suppose they keep the assignments somewhat private too. You know, it's like,
yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Okay.
Mark, do you have any sort of general thoughts about it before we get going in detail?
It's hard to know what to make of the film from the title, isn't it? It's a strange one. And when you sort of said, oh, it's a TV movie in this 1970, I thought, oh dear, it's going to be dreadful.
I think you said something. Yeah, I mean, you gave some sort of impression in your response to that in text. Oh, if I have to or something.
Although one of my favourite television series is Columbo, and that's the 70s series, and that's, they're all made for TV movies, and they're in my opinion, they're excellent. You mentioned at the beginning you thought it should have been a, or it could have been a blockbuster movie. Well, it's far too intelligent to be a blockbuster movie. It really is.
Well, I don't know. It could, it, well, maybe not blockbuster, but it could have been a, you know, there are some movies, aren't there, that are relatively successful, that are more complicated, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Steven Spielberg, one of his, I think his second film is Duel, and that was a TV movie, and that was very good, and it was released in the cinema. So I suppose, yeah, this could have been released in the cinema and become quite a cult hit, actually.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of something like The Insider, you know?
Don't know that.
Right. Have you seen that one, Frank?
No, I haven't. I mean, this sort of reminds me of the movie The Skulls. I mean, it's about a secret society in a college. I haven't seen that either, but it's kind of and that was a big blockbuster in the early 2000s. I think they even made a sequel, but
I don't actually know that one myself. The one that I was referring to was The Insider. Was about a guy whose real name was Jeffrey Wigand, and it's played by Russell Crowe, and it's all about this whistleblower in the tobacco industry and how they try to silence him, basically. And, you know, there are many themes I think that were quite similar to The Brotherhood of the Bell.
Okay.
Similar sorts of levels of sophistication and complication, which tell me that, therefore, such a film could be successful on that level.
Well, Al Pacino is in that as well,
He is, that's right. Okay, yes, he's the journalist,
There's a recent film, I know we're not supposed to go off tangent here, but there is a... a recent film called Official Secrets, which was in the cinema last year, which is the true story of this woman at GCHQ who blew the whistle on, they were asked to, I think, monitor allies, phone tap them and all that stuff. And she basically went to the press about it, and it's what they did to her and tried to do to her boyfriend, etc. And it came over just like a thriller, but actually it all happened. And you realise this stuff does go on all the time, and it's only whistleblowers who perhaps make us aware of it, really.
Yeah, they pay a great price, and the establishment generally really doesn't like them. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and also, whenever you mention a conspiracy of some sort, people sort of tend to roll their eyes, and you say, well, there are lots of conspiracies that we know about because of whistleblowers. And so imagine all the ones we don't know about.
Good point. Yeah, sure. Unfortunately, this one isn't real. Or perhaps fortunately, this one isn't real. But, you know, I think it has things to say that do touch on themes that bear on reality. I think that's for sure. It's not about the Skull and Bones secret society group at Yale University. It's not about that, but obviously it's modelled on that kind of thing. To what extent it is actually about just those kinds of college-based secret societies, I don't know. I think it's probably symbolic of something bigger than that, actually, about elitist power in general, I think. I tend to think of the guy whose lecture I included actually on TMR, the sociologist called William Dumhoff. He did a presentation called Who Rules America? And basically he was looking at what he called the power elite, mostly in the US, and how all these connections between people in academia and the political world, the corporations and military power, and how they all know each other and they all help each other along, and they're all doing deals with each other, and how, in his view, this is unhelpful for, you know, a free society. So I take this Brotherhood of the Bell thing as a kind of symbol. I'm not saying these groups don't exist, and I'm not saying there's nothing sinister about any of them, but, you know, I think to get a more serious message from this, I think it's symbolic of something bigger than that.
Yeah, but I think anything to do with companies or politics or business or academia is transactional. Mm. I mean, a lot of life is transactional. And so, you know, you get given a good job on the basis that you will be kind to, you know, X, Y, and Z person, and you will be in so-and-so's pockets. And often it's not made explicitly clear, but it's there. And you go along with it. And most of the time, your conscience isn't bothered.
I kind of agree on that, actually. I've held a lot of corporate jobs, and you kind of see, even without this overt conspiracy of like the bell, you know, you do see, oh, so-and-so just got a job as a manager, and oh, they're like the daughter of an executive or something, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
There's some sort of behind-the-scenes family connection, like, oh, this person was the child of this person's college buddy who was an executive, you know? So there is a certain degree of nepotism, and without it being necessarily like this they conspiracy, you know?
Yeah, I suppose there's an extent to which nepotism is a natural thing. Yeah. You know, you want the members of your family to succeed, so it's natural to give them advantages beyond other people. But when this becomes institutionalized, so the very way the society works, even on the level of government, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? It becomes part of the very machinery of how you know, the governing structures work. Then that becomes really obnoxious and something that you know, anybody who believes in a freer world should want to check, should want to go against, although you're never going to eradicate it altogether.
No, but I mean, what's the central character in this film obviously makes a pact, doesn't he, at the beginning?
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
So he walks into it with his eyes open.
Yes.
Now, he may think, oh, what I'm being asked to do later on is going to be quite easy to do or nothing difficult. He doesn't know that, though. So he makes a pact of unknown quality with someone. So he's not, he knows what he's, he's agreed to it. He's agreed to do something. It's not as if somebody's come over and threatened him without any kind of advance warning.
That's true. He was a foolish young man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he was 22 years earlier, and he was tempted to do this. And he, I don't know, what did he do? Fool himself into doing this? Maybe he did. But it's only later that he comes to realize the gravity of the situation.
Mm.
And he learns just how bad that was in his experience and how bad the whole thing is. Yeah. Anyway, let's get on with the first bit here and see where this takes us. So the film starts really with the initiation, which is a great place to start because it immediately captures your attention. So we have this Dr. Patterson, the professor of economics, arrives at his old college, St. George's College, arrives at 5 a.m., so it's a bit spooky to start with. We know it's 5 a.m., the sun is about to rise, and we hear five rings of the college bell rather ominously as he drives up to the campus. He parks his car next to a very nice Rolls Royce, and he walks up to the door of the fraternity, which has got the Greek letters Beta Epsilon Lambda printed on the door, which of course spells bell. We'll talk about that in a minute. And he's greeted and ushered into the library, where he meets an older man called Chad Harmon, who's waiting for him, making a pot of tea rather nicely. And they have this really congenial conversation, and that's where we learn that they're both there to perform this initiation at sunrise of a new member of the Brotherhood, and that Dr. Patterson's been through all this 22 years previously, and that this Chad Harmon is Dr. Patterson's direct senior in the Brotherhood. As I say, it's all very congenial, quite relaxed at this moment. And, you know, they're told sunrise is approaching and they need to go into the inner chamber for this initiation. And there's a tremendous change of mood at that point. So that's when they actually go into the chamber and we see the bell. And I'll get onto that in just a second. I just wanted to note about this BEL business that's on the door, these three letters, because I discovered that apparently BEL in ancient Akkadian means master. And this is where the term Baal comes from, because that also means master or lord. And of course, in the Old Testament, Baal got applied to gods other than Yahweh, you know, those that were in opposition to Yahweh. And that's where we get the name Beelzebub, Baalzebub, you know. So that connotes Satan and the devil and all that sort of thing. And I reckon BEL is all there in order to sort of connote the occult spookiness of this group. But actually, I don't know what you two think, but when we get into that initiation scene, there's actually very little that's overtly supernaturalistic and spooky in that sense about that scene at all. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't really remember anything super spooky about it. It was just kind of straightforward. They do the oath thing and then that was about it. But, you know, you bring up those supernatural connections and it's like, it's interesting to think about. But then when you see how mundane they make the procedure, it's like, you wonder if the writer was even aware of that. Or, like, subconsciously, maybe they made those connections, but then weren't really trying to, you know.
Yeah, but I think it plays on two things. I mean, first of all, the grammar of film, it sets it up to look like a kind of old Hammer horror film. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. it just plays with that to begin with, and I think that's deliberate. We know, as Julian says, this sort of vampiric thing of meeting at night before sunset and the bell and, the, and the roaring fire and the people standing around. It's sort of deliberately tapping into the horror genre. Mm. And also, when you look at secret societies or people like the Masons, they've got all these little sort of ceremonies and ways of speaking, etc. And it's there to generate, I would suggest, a certain sense of unease of the other. And it's deliberately done like that. So it's very consciously setting out to be this sort of mystical ceremony, because obviously at some point it was created. It's quite a recent thing.
Yeah, 200 years, apparently. Yeah, well, 200 years, they say.
Relatively.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, exactly.
But it's deliberate. They're deliberately doing it, both within the film and also to reflect the way real modern cults work. The mystique is kind of contrived to make you feel that you're sort of under a certain power or an obligation.
I think you're...
Can you say that?
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I am not... In saying what I'm about to say, I'm not saying that there are no groups at all that have, you know, an overtly supernatural element to them. But what we're presented with in this film, I think, is, as you describe, that it's there really to give people a buzz. It's there to give the initiates coming along the buzz that, ooh, what they're doing is, ooh, it's a bit subversive, isn't it? It's anti-cultural, it's anti-Christian, it's, it connotes the devil and things like that.
It's theatre. It's theatre,
yeah.
Sense of high church is theatre or a Masonic lodge meeting is theatre, you know.
I think there's a big element of that. And I think also there's an element of that being useful for putting off critics as well. You know, if anybody wants to criticize such a group, the temptation is going to be to go all on about the hocus pocus and say, oh, you know, they're worshipping the devil and all that sort of thing. You know, they can quite easily then say, oh, how ridiculous, we're not doing that sort of thing, and then just point to the quite mundane things like, yeah, there is a bell and, yeah, there's an oath and, you know, we open up some old books and that. And, and so it can sort of deflect serious criticism away from the group. The serious criticism, of course, would be the amount of power that they're wielding, and they can deflect that using all this buzzy stuff, which is hocus pocus, really. See, I think I agree with you. Yeah.
That's a really good point you bring up. Like, they can point to the rituals and say, no, see, it's just something involving a bell. It's not anything satanic. Ever,
absolutely. So whereas on the door it says BEL, which anybody who knows what it might mean to, oh yeah, that's got connections there, they can say, no, no, it's actually a physical bell hanging in hanging in the room. Good point, Frank. Absolutely. I've just been handed a cup of tea. How about that? Fantastic.
Aww.
Isn't that cute?
It is.
Okay, let's get on to this initiation then, because this really is a major feature of the film. They actually go into this inner chamber. We get this spooky music from the great composer Jerry Goldsmith. All these weird camera angles. We see this large bell suspended above a four-petal rose emblem on the floor. And each petal is pointing to the four points of the compass. And Chad Harmon, the guy who was making the tea, he then asks the man to be initiated, a guy called Philip Dunning, you know, if he's read the articles and the letters of the Brotherhood, has he kept them secret and is he willing to follow in absolute obedience? And of course, Dunning stands there and answers yes. Yes, you can see he's nervous, but he goes ahead and he says yes, and the group then proceeds to burn the copy of the articles and letters on the open fire. Then the men take their positions at the four points. There's Dr. Patterson, Chad Harmon, I think the porter, some other character anyway, and then Philip Dunning takes up his point facing east for the illumination as the sun comes up to the east, you know. And then Chad explains the deal. It's 200 years old, this brotherhood, and the continuity depends on absolute obedience. Your senior, that's the member just above you, will arrange anything you want in life. Make sure that you're successful in anything you want, but you have to comply with your, what he calls your due bill when this test of loyalty comes to you. So the men swear the oath together. They pledge obedience to the brotherhood, their honor, their fortune, their life. As the sun rises and the bell is hand-rung four times and then is left to ring a fifth time. I don't know if there's any significance to that. We'll maybe discuss that in just a minute. I thought the rose cross on the floor was yet another one of these sort of connotations of secret societies, you know, the Rosicrucianism, the fraternity of the Rosy Cross, which is an initiatory group. And I came across Aaron Franz on Themes and Memes talking about this film, saying that there's something significant about the number five, the fact that it's 5 o'clock in the morning, the fact there are five rings of this bell, and this is an occult number. And I don't know, I wasn't quite sure about that one, but I mean, it would fit certainly with the way the film works. This could actually be yet another bit of the hocus pocus. Anyway, I thought the music was excellent in this. Spooky glissando strings, percussive sounds, and then a sort of baroque style at the same time. It's jazzy, it's sort of like it's old and it's new at the same time. It's really cleverly done.
I mean, I've got written down on my notes Jerry Goldsmith jazz, discordant music, which is what he does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Immediately you get that from the beginning. He's an excellent choice for this film.
Absolutely. I mean, he has all those discordant sounds and percussive sounds, and then that sort of dovetails into the drum kit with the cello playing something like a Bach melody. And so, it, you know, it does, as I say, it connotes the old, as if this goes, this society reaches back hundreds of years, or perhaps thousands of years, you know, but also it's kind of upbeat, jazzy 1960s feel to it. So it's new as well. You know, we're alive in the modern world, even though we reach back into eternity, you know.
Yeah.
It's cleverly done.
Oh, so, yeah. I mean, any film is of its time.
Sure.
And the worst, the films that date most badly are the ones that try and predict the future. But this film is 1970, so I mean, it might have been made 69, script might have been produced in 1969, so it's just on that cusp of going into the 70s, and everything is new and modern. But as you say, it goes back in supposed, you know, past history, which is, for America, I suppose 200 years is pretty old, isn't it, actually? Yeah.
Yeah, Chad at some point celebrates the fact that it's 200 years, as if that is eternity in his view.
Yeah.
Actually, that would bring up an interesting point because America, we celebrated the bicentennial in 1976, so that would have been just before that. So that would mean that this society like predates, I guess, even the founding of America, you know, I guess. So
I'm surprised they didn't bring that up, actually. That would have been a good point.
I know. Yeah. They made a huge deal of it in 76. They had special coins, you know, bicentennial quarters and things like that. Yeah. Wow. I wasn't alive then, but I remember hearing about it as if it had been kind of a big deal, you know.
Was that, Frank, because you weren't born yet, or had you died and come back? I mean, as we're talking about strange things here.
No, I was born in 1980, so okay. As a kid, I'd get these quarters, you know, and I'd ask my dad, why is there this guy who looks like he's from George Washington's time or whatever, and you know, they're like, oh, it's a bicentennial quarter. And it's like, bicentennial is 200 years, you know, and that's when America was founded and all that, so... Yeah, it's weird that they didn't touch on that really in the movie, actually, but...
Yeah, they could have made a big thing of that.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Do either of you know when Skull and Bones was formed?
No.
I have a feeling that probably doesn't go back as far as that. Though typical of secret societies, they would probably claim some sort of link with belief systems, theosophical systems, which themselves would say, you know, we have beliefs that go back to the Egyptians, you know, to ancient India and things like that. So each group could sort of claim a heritage that was ridiculously long.
Well, Google is saying that the Skull and Bones was founded in 1832.
Ooh, okay. Wow, very modern.
Yeah,
very, very modern. I remember there being some sort of connection with one of the Native American tribal leaders. I think maybe Geronimo. I'm just talking off the top of my head, but I think it was Geronimo. They had his remains in there as part of their ritual stuff.
That's right. They had a skull, didn't they?
Yeah, they had the actual skull and bones of an Indian tribal leader here. And I remember hearing in the news there was something where, like, the tribe of whatever he's from was, like, trying to sue the society to get his remains back or something. And I don't know what came of that. But, yeah, it goes all the way back to the 1830s.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think it's quite in the same league, but one at Oxford called the Bullingdon Club.
Oh, I was wondering if somebody was going to mention this.
Yeah, it's kind of a dinner club, isn't it? David Cameron belonged to it. Boris Johnson, Jeremy Hunt, the other contender for the leader of the Conservative Party. Ludovic Kennedy belonged to it. David Dimbleby, Nathaniel Rothschild. I mean, you know, it's just this sort of snapshot of people in elite positions. And, you know, I'm not saying that there are oaths sworn, and I have no idea. And I have no idea whether people who are involved in that are involved with other things. And
yeah.
I really have no idea. But nevertheless, it does exist. And it, you know, it does illuminate that there are rings of influence that congregate together in this kind of way. They're all over the place. And Skull and Bones is perhaps, you know, one of the most mysterious versions of the same kind of thing.
Well, I mean, obviously, whether it's an urban myth or so, is the whole thing about the pig. David Cameron and the pig, which those listening can go and look that up. But That's a sort of pretty awful kind of initiation ceremony, if that's true.
What is that? Was initiation ceremony? I don't know the details about that. Yeah.
Wasn't there a Dark Mirror episode involving? Is that like something? Yeah. Okay.
It's basically that. So I think the pig in this case is dead. Pretty gross. But yeah, there's this idea of sort of you've got lots of money and you come from a very wealthy family, etc. You can do anything you want and you can be as sort of disgusting or whatever and within closed doors as you want.
Mm. Yeah, it's not a healthy state of affairs for sure.
No.
I wanted to bring up in this connection the conversation I had with Dr. Peter Phillips a few years ago now when I was talking with him about the Bohemian Grove, which is another one of these groups that pops up in conspiracy circles. And again, people can go overboard talking about, they worship a concrete owl in the middle of a forest, etc. and that's true. There is this owl there and they do have a ceremony around the owl. And, but what Peter Phillips was saying to me, he actually researched, he went there, he stayed with them for weeks while they were doing all this sort of thing. And in his view, though he couldn't say what individual people were thinking or speak for everybody that was there, but his general view of it was that, this particular aspect of it was not taken that seriously. It was something they did. They enjoyed together and it was part of the buzz of the group joining together, bonding together, etc. But he was quite critical of the very fact of all these rich, powerful men who had control over potentially trillions of dollars of worldly wealth, who were acting in their own and each other's interests in such a way that was potentially extremely harmful for the majority of the world's population. These people, some of them in control of more money than countries, could raise, mercenaries to go and fight a war somewhere. You know what I mean? That sort of level of wealth and leverage. And his point was that being obsessed about the group and its peculiarities is missing the point. The phenomenon itself of this power elite disconnected from the rest of society is a dangerous situation. And he was trying to say we should not be trying to drive a wedge. We should be, trying to open up channels of communication. Otherwise, the them and us is going to even grow bigger and bigger and become even more dangerous. Mm. So, when I'm looking at these, I've got a whole list of groups that came to mind, Skull and Bones and Bullingdon Club, the Delphic Club over at Harvard, the Bilderberg Group, the Bohemian Grove, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Trilateral Commission, the Freemasons, as you already mentioned, all these have a certain degree or different degrees of secrecy about them, involving people with different degrees of power intersecting with various rings and rings within rings of the power elite. It is something I think to be concerned about. But again, if we concentrate on each individual group obsessing about the bell in that group and the skull and the bones in that group and the concrete owl in that group and, to what extent are they worshipping the devil and all this sort of thing, I think it's missing the point of the bigger critique, the bigger concern about the wielding of power in the interests of the few and not the many, to misquote a phrase.
You bring that up, and I know I don't want to get off too much on a tangent, but it reminds me of a movie I rewatched again the other day, They Live. Have you guys seen that with Mike Johnson? Yeah.
I started to see it, and then I was distracted for some reason, and I've only got about a quarter of the way through, but I know the one you mean, yes.
Yeah.
It's that sort of theme, the same sort of theme, except like he puts on these glasses and finds out the whole world is run by aliens, and then all the stuff around him has like subliminal messages like obey and money says this is your god and things like that. And that's kind of like extreme take on it, but it's like it hints at that there's these groups that are trying to divide people and control society as a whole, and not for our benefit, but how much of that is actually real and how much is not is I don't know. But
I watched that and it must have been a struggle because I don't think it's a very good film. I mean, it's John Carpenter, who's an excellent director. He's done The Fog, Halloween.
It's certainly not like your typical type of movie.
No. I think the problem is Roddy Piper, the central character, is not an actor, it's a wrestler. So that's part of it. It's, in terms of acting, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, and I felt like he puts on the glasses and he just starts insulting the aliens and stuff. It's like, dude, you're going to... He steps kind of into that wrestling persona, a little bit trash talking,
But the good bits, where he looks around and the posters and everything, it's just obey, is it? Things like that, the skull.
Obey with one, marry and reproduce, that sort of thing.
I mean, that's brilliant. It reminds me of The Matrix a lot. Obviously, you're looking beyond the reality you see around you to the truth. It's a similar sort of thing. Instead of putting on the glasses, you're taking the pill, aren't you? Whichever color pill it was he takes and he can see. I think, They Live is a much better film if you describe it to someone than if you watch it, oddly enough. Right. His concept is excellent.
That's maybe why I only actually got a quarter of the way through, because I have to say I was not really grabbed by it in that first quarter.
No, it's not. Oh. I don't think it's a very good film. But it's got some very good bits in it. It's just a shame it wasn't a better quality film.
Yeah. Well, we won't do that one then.
No.
But back to this one. This guy then is told, you know, he's got to pay his due bill.
Yeah.
He has to go to this country house, this unoccupied country house. He receives an envelope, and the due bill he has to do, he's got to persuade, as I said before, this colleague of his, a Konstantin Hovarthy, strange name, who is a Soviet defector now living in the US. This guy has got to be persuaded to turn down a college position, a nice juicy dean of linguistics. He's got to turn it down because the brotherhood just wants somebody else in that position. And if Hovarthy refuses, then Patterson has this other envelope that he could then just post off to the Soviet embassy. And it's a dossier listing all the people who helped this guy defect from Russia. So, of course, you know, all these people back in Russia are going to go to prison for their life or be executed or whatever. So there's huge pressure there. And, you know, Patterson decides to do the nice thing, first of all, just, you know, don't take this job. You don't have to take this job. Be happy where you are. You know, it's fine. And then you could see with Glenn Ford's acting there, you know, just how... I think he does that really well. He's trying to be friendly, yet he's reluctant to say what he's saying, and at the same time, he's fearful of what the reaction is going to be. You can see all that in his face. I think he does it. One of the best things I've seen him do. I haven't seen him do many things, but the few films that I have seen, I think this, you know, he does it extremely well. Anyway, this guy says, I've survived communism and I've survived fascism. I can survive this. You know, I'm going to do what I think is right. And so then Patterson brings out the document. These are the chaps that helped you back in the Soviet Union, and the guy runs off down the corridor, and the next scene is we find that he's committed suicide. So, of course, Patterson then is absolutely broken by this and wants to spill the beans on the whole thing. And this is where it, I suppose, the film turns a corner here, because this is where you start to see everything kick in against Patterson. He's trying to do the right thing now. He wants to escape this dreadful oath responsibility that he's got. And he finds the pressure from the tentacles of this organization just everywhere. He tells his wife about all this, of course. He wants to tell all. She persuades him, just go and see my dad about this. A guy called Harry Masters, who is played by Morris Evans, the English actor, who I think was in Rosemary's Baby. This is the other place I saw him. Really good at playing sort of devious, slightly spooky English characters. Anyway, Harry Masters here, who says, you know, he'll help out here. And he says, don't go to the police. They're not going to be able to handle cases like this. Go to the feds. He says, I've got a friend, an agent friend, works for the Federal Security Service called Thaddeus Burns. He'll help you out. So Harry takes Dr. Patterson off, his son-in-law, off to this federal building to meet this so-called agent, who turns out to be a member of this organization. So it's really weird that he's trying to spill the beans about the whole story, and he's actually spilling the beans to somebody who is unknown to him, a part of the very group itself. Really spooky moment.
Great scene, isn't it?
It is, actually, yeah. It's an almost bare office.
Yes.
They go in and they say, well, you know, this is strange. There's hardly anything in this office. And this Mr. Burns explains, oh, yeah, this is a cover office for whistleblowing conversations, you know. So he sort of accepts that. Well, okay, it's a cover office. And then later in the film, he finds out that, no, this agent never existed. Yeah. Never really was an agent. There was never an office there at all.
Yeah.
And Harry, his wife's dad, is also part of this group and has set all that up. You know, one thing after another like that. And he goes to see Harry to complain. You know, you set me up with all this. And Harry sat there with a psychiatrist next to him. And Harry says to his son-in-law, we're really concerned about you, that you're, you know, you're going off the rails here. Yeah. My psychiatrist friend here thinks the same. And so he's, you know, kind of undercutting him and making him feel doubts about his own sanity. It's great the way these things are portrayed in the movie, I think.
No, totally. It's in the nature of this sort of film, isn't it? The conspiracy thing, that I'm sure there's more than one film where somebody will escape from somewhere. You'll watch him running along, trying to escape. He finds a taxi. The taxi takes him to somewhere. And basically, the person just takes him right back to where he's escaped from, which is, you know, this sense you can't trust anyone and everyone is involved with the conspiracy.
Yes.
Very frustrating.
One of those techniques to make you think, you know, I'm going around the bend here.
Yeah.
And it begins to have that effect upon Dr. Patterson, doesn't it? He becomes more and more paranoid. So, I mean, the accusation could be against him. You know, you're paranoid thinking there's a conspiracy going on. But they actually make him paranoid because of the way they work upon him. So he ends up exuding some of the very character faults that people would accuse him of.
I mean, I've got a quote. It's a little while since I've seen the film, but I wrote this line down, and I'm not quite sure where it happens in the film. But the line is, presumably somebody's talking to him and says, isn't it true no one believes you and those that do don't care?
Ah, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is a kind of quite a startling line. I wrote that one down.
Yeah, I think that's when for me, that's when the movie starts to get like really good. It makes you start thinking like, well, how deep does the conspiracy go? Mm-hmm. Like, how many tentacles does the monster have? You know, and it's...
Yes.
I think I remember telling you after I had seen it, Julian, that that sort of aspect of it reminded me of The Prisoner, where like,
right.
Yes. You know, I think that was what I was thinking of, The Prisoner, when he escaped.
Where he like escaped and then like he gets right back into the hands of the village. You know, it's like that connected to his old job and everything. Very similar happening here, where you mentioned the taxi driver brings him back and then, you know, the apartment is no longer, you know, all that stuff is just like, oh man, it's just like one of those moments after another. I'm just like, oh no. It's like, you know, and then it starts to come off as paranoid because like, yeah, they are making him doubt his sanity because he goes back and then that place is different now. So just a total mind blowing few moments there, you know. I really enjoyed that part.
And they're people that he thinks of as his friends.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
His friends, his wife.
Yeah. But, that made me think too, like, even his wife was like somehow connected to the bell, you know.
Yes.
Maybe a way to check him later on if they needed to, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You put yourself in somebody's shoes who, it's not like faceless people he meets in an office. It's people he knows for years and years and years and calls friends who are not believing him. And that's, you know, what really makes him question his sanity, I think.
Yes. Mm. Yes, they've managed to mold his whole life around the provisions of the group, haven't they? Mm. So obviously he has married this woman. I'm not, you know, there's no indication really that it's a sham of a marriage, but he's married her and her father is in this group.
Mm.
And, you know, when she, well, I think she's the one who says that line that you came out with, Mark. What was that line again?
Isn't it true that no one believes you and those that do don't care?
Yeah, I think she says that. Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, so there's very much this sense that his whole life has been sort of molded around this group. And so to try and then break out of that is incredibly difficult because he's got pressures coming from every single side, gaslighting him, you know, making him doubt his own sanity.
Yeah.
Tremendous pressure that he's under.
Because in lots of small ways, I think one does compromise one's feelings or instincts in very small ways. If you're in a group situation and everyone feels one way about something, you tend to go, well, okay, for the sake of argument, I'll slot in with what you think, just because you don't want to keep going against the flow. So I think in very small ways, that's a thing that happens to all of us. And he's facing it in a much more serious way. And how much does he actually persist in fighting against everyone who seems to be disbelieving? Because of course, he has no proof.
Mm-hmm.
No, and yet the burden of proof is on him all the time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's what's so fascinating about this. He has this case to prove for which he has very little actual evidence except in his own experience. He's got to try and persuade anybody else about it. A lot of the people who he's trying to persuade are already in on it, connected in some way, so don't want to listen to him anyway and want to make things more difficult for him. But anybody who is outside of that case, I mean, there's his boss, his immediate boss at the university, he isn't in on it, but he becomes so paranoid after a while that he thinks even he's involved in it as well, but he actually isn't involved in it. So the burden of proof is always upon him.
He could, at any time, he could just drop it, couldn't he?
That's true, he could,
He could just decide this is all too much, but he doesn't, and it's that sort of strength of character that almost becomes madness because he's fighting against everybody for this thing that he believes in. But I mean, you can see how he's viewed to other people as being just a bit bonkers, really. Those who aren't in on it
and conspiring therefore to make him seem bonkers as well.
Well, it's the classic conspiracy theory thing, you know. Somebody might have an interesting idea about a situation, but they're made to feel like they're mad, and so they almost appear more mad the more you call them mad, and they try and defend themselves, and they're just constantly, it's very hard for any person who doesn't believe in the narrative that we're supposed to believe, the governments, to actually appear sane. Do you see what I mean? It's a sort of a vicious cycle almost.
Yes, he's not in control of the narrative. The media is actually quite a big part, isn't it, of this, because the media controls the narrative and can twist things very effectively. And this comes out with, he has a number of interviews because he goes to the TV nightly news to tell all, and you can see how the media starts to skew things. No doubt there are people involved with the Brotherhood of the Bell who are in the media and making sure this happens. You don't see that, but you take that as read. You know, there's a lawyer who's interviewed who says that this conspiracy is too lurid for my tastes. You know, I mean, lurid is a very weasel term. It just means basically it's implausible, you know.
Yeah.
And then Chad Harmon, who is his direct superior in the group, is interviewed. And he does this kind of limited hangout thing on the news where he says, yeah, I belong to the Brotherhood. It exists. And there's an inner chamber with a bell. And he sort of says so much about it, but gives the impression that it's basically benign. You know, there's plenty of charm. He knows and can name some of the reporters who are reporting on the case.
Yeah.
You know, he has this sort of limited hangout approach to it and laughs. And you know, I think rather like, I think John Kerry was, you know, as a member of the Skull and Bones, as was George W. Bush, you know, both sides of the political divide there. And, you know, they both laughed it off when they were asked about it. You know, oh, yeah, you know, it exists and it kind of doesn't mean anything, you know. So, yeah, the media skews things in that way. And indeed, Harry Masters, Patterson's father-in-law, is also interviewed on the TV. And he basically tries to make the case that his son-in-law's off his rocker, you know. A weird, spooky way that the media is made to work against Patterson. When he's obviously thinking, this is my chance to get the story out, and it ends up working against him.
Yeah. I mean, I've always got a soft spot for films about studios or TV studios. That scene is extremely well done when he's being interviewed on telly. I always like the idea that this is a film being made in a studio, and they're using the studio that they're making the film in to represent a studio. So I always like that as a concept, anyway, as a conceit. And whenever it happens, I always think it's brilliant, because you're asking the audience to view the film that's shot in a studio featuring the studio the film is shot in as a studio. Just a, sort of off what we're talking about, but I always like that. So it's a particularly well done scene.
I kind of agree with that. Yeah, I just thought that moving on to the aspect of his conspiracy where he's trying to get the media to work with him. And as you said, the burden of proof is on him always, and the media being twisted. In real life, you see the media twisting stories so often to fit a certain agenda. And to see them do it in this case, you know, and then the whole conspiracy gets laughed off. And it's like, yeah, if this was true, this is totally what would happen. I mean, back in the 70s or even now, like when you mentioned John Kerry and George Bush, it's like, you know, somebody in the media at the time, they're like, okay, if you look at the odds, what are the odds that two Bonesmen would be running for president against each other at the same time? I mean, what are the odds of that? I mean, come on, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, that's right.
I mean, it reminds me of the George Carlin bit where he talks about politics. And he's like, it's all, and of course, he uses much more profanity than this, but he's like, it's one big club and you ain't in it. It's like,
that's right.
You and I ain't in it. We're not in the club. You know, it's like, it definitely tells you that, yeah, there is a club. The media's at the mercy of the club to a certain extent. And even if they're not, they're easily manipulated into the sensationalism and poking fun at somebody, you know, with a outlandish theory like this, you know. So I thought bringing the media into this aspect of his story was really clever. And it was so on the nose that I'm just like, done in the 70s or, you know, or done now. I mean, it's like one of the timeless pieces that makes this movie work, I think, is it just makes him more frustrated and more desperate and more paranoid after that, you know.
It reminded me a bit of the China Syndrome. Have either of you seen that?
I have not.
Oh,
you seen? I long, long time ago, yes.
Because Jack Lemmon is trying to convince people this nuclear reactor is unsafe, and he's, I think he locks himself into the control room, and they do a live broadcast where he's trying to convince people that this nuclear reactor is unsafe. And it's brilliant because at that point, he's so almost incoherent that he can't get his words out and he can't tell people what he should. And it's really, really, really sort of frustrating, sitting there thinking, just be concise, just tell people, convince people. And, and of course, he looks like a madman, which is, you know, what happens at the end of this film. It's like he's the only one marching in step. He's the only one who knows the truth, as it were. And it's sort of trial by audience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which you often get on the...
Oh, that's right. You do at the end of this film, towards the end, which we'll come on to in just a minute, when he's on that daytime TV program, isn't it?
Yeah.
I made some notes here about the CIA document countering criticism of the Warren Report. And there were a couple of things, actually, that did strike me about similarities to this. So this is a memo that was sent to CIA assets in the media to discourage criticism, you know, about the official findings of the Kennedy assassination. And for anybody who's interested to read it, it's CIA 1035-960, Countering Criticism of the Warren Report. Go and find it. It's actually on the Mind Renewed website for anybody who's interested.
Will they monitor you if you read it?
Probably not. Not now.
No, that sort of thing is what you put into the village, Julian.
Sorry?
That sort of information is what you put into the village.
Oh, yes. You'll be there too, Frank, won't you?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, it was just a couple of things that reminded me of it. This guy, Chad Harmon, says, you know, the fraternity has 40,000 members with 18 chapters in various colleges, you know. It would be impossible to keep these dark secrets, even if they existed, from coming out, sort of thing. And, you know, in the Countering Criticism of the Warren Report, one of the things that the journalists are encouraged to say is, this is a direct quote, conspiracy on the large scale often suggested would be impossible to conceal in the United States. It reminded me of that slightly. And, you know, when the lawyer says, oh, it's too lurid, I thought, again, we've got something here in this official CIA document says, to say that these people are hasty and inaccurate in their research, that they're infatuated with their own theories. Mm-hmm. So I thought, yeah, the lawyer's saying, oh, it's too lurid, it's too over the top, it's too fanciful, it's too sensational for me. There were things that connected, in my mind anyway, just a few things with that CIA memo on ways to undermine people's reporting. Just an interesting connection there. So, yeah, I want to get on to the ratings show we've just been talking about. Just skip past this bit where there's a problem with his wife. She leaves him and he's beginning to think, you know, basically the Brotherhood of the Bell put up my marriage in the first place, to be honest. So how much is this a real marriage anyway? And there's pressure on his dad as well. They set him up for tax fraud. So all sorts of pressures going on. Anyway, he decides to go on to this ratings show in the hope that somehow this is going to allow him to give the full account of his story rather than just being on the news, where, of course, it's all heavily edited and that. So he thinks this is a chance. And in fact, the chat show host called Bart Harris, played by William Conrad, he says that kind of thing. He says, you know, this is a direct quote. He says, if you tell the truth, this TV lens will show it. You see the camera looking at, you know, and then he says, nothing shows up a phony quicker than this either. So he gives them the warning there. So if what you're saying is true, it will come out. However, Patterson gives his story. Now, the interesting thing is, well, I listened to Aaron Franz's podcast about this, and he says that Patterson actually gives his story in a really good, calm way, and the audience goes along with it, tends to believe him. The version that I saw, you know how these films are sometimes cut down to size for whatever reason, that bit wasn't there, so I can only go along with what Aaron said there, but the audience was initially persuaded. And then, out of the TV audience of this ratings show, various people are brought forward to speak, and they start undermining him. Now, presumably, they're put up to do this. You get a black guy comes up, comes to the microphone. He's sort of a Black Panther figure. And he basically says that, oh, yeah, this guy's part of a racist organization. the Brotherhood of the Bell is a racist organization, like most of the people in the USA would approve of, kind of thing. And it upsets everybody in the audience. Mm-hmm. And then this woman comes up and she says she can't give her name, but she's a patriot, you know, immediately implying that Patterson's not a patriot. Mm-hmm. And that he's secretly a Jew. And of course, the Brotherhood of the Bell is a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, you know, international Jewry. So she's this token anti-Semite who, you know, sort of smears his reputation in that sense. And then even the host, he's obviously causing trouble to push up the ratings. He then says, oh, yeah, but it is a conspiracy, but you're all wrong. It's a Catholic conspiracy against the USA. He's just playing it all. And then he berates everybody in the audience. Yeah. You all believe in conspiracies. You should be grateful how wonderful this country is. You're all a bunch of idiots. And then there's a great big fight. Yeah. It's a great scene. I just love the way there are so many techniques used in there, which you actually do see taking place in the media. I mean, Mark, you will know so well, the whole anti-Semitism thing thrown out against the Labour Party viciously before the election.
Well, something like anti-Semitism or racism, sexism, or whatever, once that word has entered the conversation, it's very hard to take it back. They're such sort of buzzwords, aren't they, now? If somebody dares to tweet something or say something that could be misconstrued as possibly racist, that's it. There's no chance of talking or discussing his intent. They're sacked. And it's amazingly prescient that this should be 1970, sort of 50 years ago, isn't it? 50 years ago. But we've come to this place now where once you're accused of that, that's it.
That's
21st
it, yes.
century. Which,
and if you, say you're not, then that's even more proof that you are.
It's
who would deny it but somebody who's guilty?
It's the same in witch trials. I mean, it's simply that, isn't it? That, you know, nothing they can do about it. Because as you so rightly say, if you throw them in a water. If they sink, they're innocent. If you float, they're a witch, so you burn them.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Of course, there's this one. Everything is thrown at him, isn't it? I know it's kind of a microcosm of the whole thing, really. But nevertheless, you know, if we take this as a scene, functioning as a scene, he's you know, accused of being a member of a Catholic conspiracy and a Jewish conspiracy and a racist conspiracy. And the overall effect of this is just to make him, however good his testimony might have been there in front of the camera in the first place, it doesn't matter anymore. Mm. The audience, apparently, according to Aaron Franz, the audience was with him to start with. Now they're all over the place. They've been insulted. Yeah. They can't agree with him now because they'll be then considered, what, an anti-Semite? I don't want to be considered that, you know?
Yeah.
So they're being manipulated tremendously by this. It's a great scene. And
Yes.
I agree with Mark on that too. Like, once those buzzwords enter the conversation, that's it. You have no recourse after that. You're just done.
I mean, I suppose that's the bit in the film. Yeah. Up until then, the film has been fairly underplayed and believable, and then that sort of enters the realm of satire for me a little bit.
I agree. Yeah.
You know,
I think that's true. Yeah.
Not criticizing. I'm just saying, well, they've upped it so much now.
No, I think you're right. Yes.
You've gone along with this, then go along with this, which is sort of preposterous, really.
Yeah.
But as you say, Julian.
Well, that works because it is sort of daytime TV, isn't it? And the host himself plays it like that. I mean, you can see he's chuckling when he goes, actually, it's all a Catholic conspiracy. And he's going, you know, he's trying not to laugh because he's just playing. He doesn't care.
No, he's
probably got a brief from somebody to say, hey, now go and push this one.
As you say, it's ratings.
Yeah, ratings for him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that he's been given the go-ahead. You know, you're not going to get into trouble for this one. Go for it,
mate. You wonder if the host is part of the organization somehow, too, if he's in their pocket. You know, at that point, they don't really show you anyone else who's connected. But then you're just wondering, is everybody in the audience, is the host a plant? You know, how far do the tentacles go in this last couple of scenes? You know?
I mean, my reading of that scene is that the host, the TV host, is not in anyone's pocket. He's doing his job. He's doing his job. But they're using him and they're using that aspect to set it up, if you like.
Yes.
The way it's shot, to me, implies that the audience members are in on it. It's very sort of, you know, closed right up to the eyes and the mouth. It's very sort of, the directing is saying, look, these people are almost caricatures, if you like.
Interesting. I would agree. We see the mouth shot of the people who come up to the microphone. I think they're in on it.
Yes. Yeah, those people I meant, yeah.
They're paid off to do it. But the general members of the audience, I think, represent the general population being swayed by one narrative or the other. And, of course, enter a state of fear where they think, ooh, initially I agreed with this guy, but, ooh, now if I agree, that makes me a wacky conspiracy theorist. I must back off from that. You see that happening. And, of course, they're insulted by saying, oh, you mean I'm a white supremacist? How dare you, you know? Mm. So they're all being manipulated, as, of course, people generally are manipulated. But I totally agree with you. The host himself, I don't think he's like a member of the Bell.
Mm-hmm. No.
But there's some member of the Bell in the production team somewhere who said, go for this one, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
If the host himself is not, then someone is, you know?
Mm. I really think that in itself is quite an important truth because, you know, it's often said with these sort of conspiracy things, oh, you mean it's a huge conspiracy and everybody's in on it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to be a conspiracy. There are multiple conspiracies. And of course, there are rings within rings, not just within a group, but outside intersecting with spheres of influence. And all you need is some producer who maybe is connected to it in some way just to say that's yours, go for it. You won't get into trouble with that one. Great ratings for that one. You know, and this I reckon this is how the power structures work, you know.
I mean, have either of you read or seen Julius Caesar Shakespeare play?
No.
You've got me there, Mark, because as you know, I do not like Shakespeare, so I
didn't actually know that. Okay.
No, we studied Macbeth at school. It put me off for life, I'm afraid.
Well, lots of things, at school can click up. But I there's an amazing scene. It's the Antony Friends Romans Countryman Lemuel is that scene.
I've only ever seen that in comedy sketches, but no, go on.
Well, it's breathtakingly brilliant because he's addressing a crowd and he's saying, I've come to bury Caesar, not to praise. I'm not going to praise Caesar. So everyone's going, right, because they didn't like Caesar. The evil that men do lives after them, the good is often. But during the course of the speech, he gradually just completely changes what he's saying about Caesar and the audience just the crowd mentality goes along with him because of the oration. It's a brilliant piece of oration and it's basically proud, yay, we agree with you, and they go, oh, okay, you know, we agree with you, oh, and then at the end of it they've actually completely changed
really?
What they've been
right.
agreeing with to begin with.
Yes.
It's brilliant. The persuasion of crowds.
Yeah.
And as you know, we mentioned, it's just a few buzzwords needed and everyone, oh no, we can't agree with this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you make me want to see it now, actually, Mark.
Just Google that particular scene. The BBC adaptation of that is only like 5 minutes, but it's just brilliantly done. It's cleverly done. And going back to the brother to the bell, that scene in the studio, if it was just between him and the host, it was like a one-to-one, it'd be completely different, wouldn't it? He probably would convince the host or convince the people at home that he wasn't that.
Yes.
But it's having the crowd and those few stooges in it that does the trick.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And do you also agree that that is a kind of microcosm of the macrocosm of media generally? You know what I mean?
Just the cosm.
Well, it is. All right, okay. I'll try to be less grandiose about it. It's just, you know what I mean? It's a snapshot, isn't it, of a bigger point that's being made.
Yeah, yeah.
That the TV-watching nation can be manipulated by some well-placed testimonies from individuals.
Absolutely.
Who themselves don't actually really know what the full narrative is. They're just paid to do it, so they do it. And then they're lost, you know, in the mists of history. And that's it, as far as they're concerned. But they play their little cog part, and, you know, somebody's controlling the narrative. The problem is, this guy can't control the narrative, and that's, he trusts in the media, doesn't he? I mean, he goes to the media a number of times, thinking, this is the Fourth Estate. This is going to really change it for me. And he finds he cannot control the narrative. Somebody else is in control of that, and they've got little cogs in place who themselves don't know. It's compartmentalized. They don't know what's going on. They don't know the bigger story, but they can be like a chessboard. They can be put into particular positions, and it undermines his testimony. He has this burden of proof. Everything's on his shoulders, and he can't do anything about it. The only sort of chink of light that comes out at the end, we sort of get this idea of a solution when his boss at the university, this guy called Jerry, he sort of figures out that Patterson was right all along. And so this guy, Jerry, then actually comes up with what seems to be a solution. He says, look, why don't you find somebody else within the fellowship of this Brotherhood of the Bell who will join you to give a testimony? You're not just the crazy guy then, are you? Because there's somebody else backing up your story. So he actually goes to the chap who he initiated, was involved in initiating at the beginning of the film, this Dunning guy. And he manages to persuade him, look, you've not had any hand up yet by the secret society. You know, they've not done anything really for you. You haven't got much to lose. Your life is not sort of crafted or molded around the society yet. Mine has been. So why don't you get out of it now before your due bill comes up? Just break free of it now and join me and we'll break the story. So at the end of the film, there's a lovely moment where Patterson's lonely walking towards the checkout area of the flight, and it's a lonely corridor, and it's just his footsteps.
It's this long corridor, goes on forever.
It's huge, that's right, yeah, and it's dully illuminated, and in the distance you hear these footsteps, and he's coming to join him. It's that wonderful moment that, there's light literally at the end of this tunnel. But, you know, it's left there, so you have to write the ending for yourself. But what do you think? Is there light at the end of this tunnel or not?
I'm gonna guess maybe not, because even if he gets this young chap to help him, I mean, this kid is like just initiated. He doesn't have any dirt on. He doesn't have anything to go with either. He's gonna have even less proof than the main character. You know, he's not gonna put his whole life at risk like that. You know, I don't think.
No.
Are you sure? Because he does join him though, doesn't he? He does join him on that flight to go back to LA. And so you're saying that maybe he chickens out at the last minute, are you?
Maybe they get to him. I don't know. I guess I don't really remember that part specifically so much. The ending for me was like he gets on the talk show and is like discredited by the talk show. And that's kind of, I don't really remember much after that, because I don't know if I saw everything after that.
I can understand why you wouldn't remember the ending, because that is just literally this. It just doesn't really end properly, does it? You know, they just meet in this corridor and you think, oh, wow, they're going to try and break this story together. You never see them break the story. Presumably, well, this is it. You don't even know that they do. It's left as a question mark. Yeah.
I don't know. I think they would be really up against, even if they get, they would need somebody else who's been in the organization longer, who's kind of similar to, had a similar due bill and he was not happy about it, you know, sort of thing to happen. He'd have to get somebody who'd have documents and all that kind of stuff to come out with it. You know, this young guy, even if he goes on with it, he's not going to have the kind of proof that they're going to need to break this story. I mean, with this young kid, he could maybe get on like a today, like a Alex Jones or something, you know, and that's not going to get him very far, you know.
No. You could easily craft a narrative around that. Could you say this? We don't even know who this guy is.
Right, exactly.
He says he's an initiate. We never even met him before.
Exactly.
He's trying to cozy up to this academic because he wants to be successful himself. He's just making it up.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, even if this kid is going to help him, I mean, they're going to be in the same sinking boat. He needs somebody like his father-in-law or somebody to come out with it, you know, or somebody who's been in on it up till now and who doesn't like it. Even if you have take the optimistic view, like I think you might, he's still going to be facing an uphill battle, you know?
Yeah, I want to be optimistic, but I'll share with you in a minute, but I do take the pessimistic view of it as well. Mark, what do you think?
Well, it seems a little bit like a sort of coda added on by the TV executives who perhaps were a little worried that this TV movie would be a bit downbeat.
I see what you mean. So, possibly.
If you were a particularly positive sort of person, you could say, oh, well, perhaps it'll all be okay. But if you're perhaps like me, a little bit pessimistic, you're going, well, it's not going to help, is it really? two people against this vast machine isn't really going to make much difference, is it?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, well, I think we're all three agreeing on that. I think one of the big things that creates that sense of optimism is, again, the music towards the end, which becomes more like a toccata or something. It's really upbeat and the speed of it increases. And so you really feel like, oh, something's about to happen, you know. But I mean, my immediate reaction was, you know, this organization's 200 years old. Have they not come across this before? Mm-hmm. Every other step of the way, they're ready for him.
Yeah.
They study psychology. This is what they're about. They have to study psychology in order to be in the game this long. That's what they're about, isn't it? Just manipulating people to their advantage.
Yeah.
Have they really not come across this supposed solution of two people joining together? You know, they're ready for it. So, yeah, however...
Well, how do you know the other guys in part of it?
Well, that's right.
How do you know the other guys in part of it? That would be more in the general start of the film, I think.
It would be, yeah. So I suppose overall it does come over as rather negative. But what I take positively from the whole film itself is not so much the narrative of how the film ends, which we've just discussed, probably is negative when you analyse it, but the very fact of the film itself being there, to quote another film, being there out in the media space, which I think is something that people do take seriously. I mean, I do take this film seriously as actually saying something real about the world of power, as we said at the beginning. So I think the film in itself is a statement of hope, because it is something that people can latch onto and say, yeah, actually, there are aspects of the real world that are like that. And, you know, if we pay attention to that, and more people pay attention to that, we will realize that things are not quite as open and straightforward as our supposedly democratic open societies pretend to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, chaps, what do you think?
Well, it's telling you, I think it's saying, if you think there is some injustice somewhere, then fight against it, you know, essentially. Although ultimately it's also telling you there's no point.
Thanks for that. Yeah,
that's right. No, so perhaps the film is ultimately a tool of these vast conspiracies.
Well, that's interesting. That, no, I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. In that case, I'm going to go for the optimistic view and say, yeah, they bring it, contradict myself and say, I really do believe they bring this off and they break the whole thing open. Yeah. Frank, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm going to say, you know, I like your thought that, you know, the existence of this film is sort of like a way to kind of stick it to the power structure. But in a way, I mean, if it is that, and it kind of could be, then that explains why it's such an obscure film that nobody now, probably you grab 10 people on the street, none of them would have seen it, you know. I'm thinking, you know, that's also indicative of why it would be effective as a tool of kind of waking people up, is like, it sort of exists, but it's like, you know, they let it stay out there and it's there, anybody can watch it freely, but nobody is. And I think that's also kind of a statement that, you know, they're not concerned about it, you know, like the power structure is not threatened by it, even if people do watch it and find out and wake up, because it's going to be ridiculed away, you know, because there's some parts of it that are just, although it's well done, I think it's over the top. Like, my biggest thing was the talk show scene. It's like, on one hand, I feel it's really brilliant. Yeah, it shows how easily this sort of stuff can get laughed off and swept under the rug. But at the same time, I don't feel it's like on one hand, I don't feel it's as sinister as the movie should have gotten with taking care of this guy. You know, if I was writing this story, you know, I would have had something more sinister happen to shut him up. But at the same time, I mean, what's the perfect way to discredit somebody is you laugh him off, you know, and that's why it's simultaneously frustrating, brilliant, and also kind of silly, you know. It's kind of all those at once. And its existence is important, but at the same time, it's not. It's threatening in a way, but it's also not, it's like a mosquito buzzing. It's not really that threatening, you know.
Can I just say my last few thoughts about the film?
Do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like I said, I'd never heard of it before. I enjoyed it very much. And I think, you know, Glenn Ford is amazing. Absolutely astonishingly good acting. Entirely convincing all the way through. And the script is very intelligent. If I had a criticism, the camera work is sometimes just a little bit too over the top with these lenses, these sort of fisheye lenses that swooping around and going right up to his nostrils and sort of.
I love that. I love that.
Do you?
Because
I just think there's a little too.
I know what you mean, but you know, I reckon we're always seeing things from Patterson's viewpoint, though, aren't we? We're seeing the whole story through his mind.
Yeah.
He's paranoid and all this. So if the scene actually does go a weird sort of Batman kind of angle, I don't think Batman. I think, you know, oh yeah, this is how he's seeing things. It works for me.
Okay.
Yeah, that's really weird. I know.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
I found it a little intrusive at times, a little too over the top.
Fair enough.
But that's right. I'd rather have that than just put the camera there and let the actors perform. You know, it's actually got a lot of style.
Yeah. What about Dean Jagger as Chad, his direct superior? Dean Jagger, excellent choice.
Mm.
He could be so friendly and nice one minute and then give the most serious stare you've ever seen in the world for the next one.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a great choice of actor.
And, of course, Will Gear, who plays Professor Patterson's father. Of course, you know who he is, don't you?
Who?
Grandpa Walton.
Oh, is he really? Oh, gosh, yes. That's right.
But I wasn't sure, but I Googled him, and yes, there he is, an early Grandpa Walton.
Wow.
So there we go.
Yeah. Oh, that's a nice homely finish there to our conversation, Mark. Thank you very much for that. Bringing us back to the Waltons. Wow.
Yes. Can I ask you a question, Julian? Sort of devil's advocate question, because you're the one who suggested this film.
Yes.
What would actually stop them just from killing him, making it look like an accident?
Uh-huh.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be easier than this? At some point, just somebody run him over in a street, you know.
I think that's ultimately a possibility, but I do have an answer to that.
Right.
This is not the first time this has happened, I reckon. I reckon we're to read that this has happened many, many times before.
Okay.
And if they kill everybody who does this, then it's going to be more obvious what's going on.
Yeah.
If, however, they gently, selectively discredit people, you know, to different degrees of discrediting, then they have the plausible deniability, you know, that a certain number of people in the society are going to go off the rails anyway, you know, like anybody does, you know. It's that plausible deniability. But if they just kill everybody off, it ain't going to wash, is it? So
yeah.
Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah.
That's why there's a Clinton body count, right? So, on that thought, though, wasn't there one scene where somebody gets shot? I remember there being some scene where somebody tried to come in and that person gets shot and like he thought it was somebody trying to kill him, but maybe it was just his neighbor.
Yes.
Do you remember that scene, Julian?
I do remember that scene. It was his wife. Uh-huh. She was alone in the house and the electricity goes off. And the next door neighbor comes in because the next door neighbor is concerned. I think maybe they think there's an intruder or something, you know, where they come into the house and she thinks he's an intruder. She's freaked out by the whole bell thing. So she shoots as he's coming up the stairs. He's not killed. He's badly wounded. And that's sort of a turning point for her where she thinks, I can't take any more. And they part.
Right.
Patterson says to her, even you were provided for me by the society. I'm not sure your love is genuine. And she says rather unconvincingly, I don't know what you mean. So, yeah, she knows exactly what he means, I think. I think she does love him, but she's aware that she's sort of been brought up with this. I don't know. It's difficult to analyze her as a character.
Yeah.
But it happens to her. Yeah, she's freaked out by this experience because she's caught up in the paranoia of it all.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if maybe that neighbor, the thought I had from that scene was like maybe the neighbor was coming to take him out, you know, and then,
I don't read it that way.
I don't know.
Mm. Or fire a warning shot or something.
You know, he comes in under the guise of being concerned and to check on them. I mean, who does that when the power goes out at their neighbor's house? You know, it's just weird.
That is weird. That's either a poor bit of the screenplay or, as you say, it's something perhaps a little bit strange going on.
Yeah, I personally read something more sinister into it. I think they were going to rub him out and then it failed because he wasn't there and then their guy gets shot, you know, because The wife, I think she's relatively clueless. She's just reaping the benefits. You know, her dad's in the society, her husband's in the society, but in the end, she's just enjoying the comfortable life.
I get that impression.
I think the neighbor was in on it, going to rub out the husband, but I don't have any proof of that. I'm just
it's a possibility.
It's a very male-dominated film, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yes.
Female parts are not particularly roundedly written, are they?
No, that's true.
It's of its time in that sense.
It certainly is of its time. But recommending people look at it, it is a great film. There's so much as you got from this conversation. It really is worth watching. There's a lot to reflect upon, a lot that reflects upon the reality of things going on even in the world today. Very much so. Mm. You know, the persecution that particularly whistleblowers experience, etc., and people trying to investigate establishment crimes and the like. It has an awful lot to say. So thank you ever so much, gentlemen, for coming on to talk about it. Enjoyed it very much, and I hope this is just going to be the first of a massive series that we will conduct over the next several decades here.
Yeah. Hundreds and hundreds of films.
And so our next appointment may be even in, I don't know, 6 months from now, and we may get through an awful lot. Yeah. Anyway, no, honestly, thanks ever so much for joining in with this. It's been great, and I hope people will somehow or other watch the film and enjoy it, and join us next time when we have another chat. Thanks again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Julian.
The world elides in the sway of the wicked one, refusing to rule of the risen sun. Fools in high places, ruling over you, holding the aces as they lie to you. You gotta dig for truth. You gotta dig.